Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what's a podcast?
A podcast is a thing humans invented to procrastinate from doing important things, like actual work or spending time with their families.
Neat. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about the Season 3 finale, Chapter 39, Season 3, Episode 12, Pandemonium. Written by Megan Amram and Jan Statsky. Directed by Mike Schur, including guest cast Brandon Scott Jones, Kirby Hall-Baptiste, and Maya Rudolph. Michael has a panic attack as the first subject, John, wakes up, so Eleanor takes on the role of neighborhood architect and shows him around. Tahani recognizes John as a gossip columnist who tortured her on Earth, and they realize the bad place has sent four people who will be uniquely difficult for the four humans running the experiment. When Chidi's person turns out to be his ex, Simone, he decides Michael needs to erase all his memories of her and the Soul Squad in order to not blow up the whole thing. Michael gives Chidi and Eleanor a send-off gift of a movie compilation of their love throughout all the 800 different reboots. Michael then erases Chidi's memories, and Eleanor welcomes Chidi to the neighborhood as a stranger. My guests today are creator of the show, Mike Schur, and Ted Danson, who plays Michael. Ted and Mike, welcome. Everything is meaningless.
I was wondering what you were going to go with.
That's what the pause was when Grant wanted me to start the show, and I was trying to fill in that blank.
Interesting. Why'd you go with meaningless?
Because later, as we'll see, Chidi suggests that time is meaningless.
Mm.
Jeremy, bear me, baby. Also, I considered going with one of the food puns. There are some fun restaurants snuck into this episode.
Sure.
I nearly said, welcome, everything is, man, I don't know. Because that is how I feel about this.
Yeah.
I'm having a strong memory. We got this script sent to us, I think back in July. We were all working. We were shooting a previous episode. Because this season was weird in the sense that we shot out of order a little bit, I think, for schedules and for locations and things.
Yes, correct. We shot it absurdly out of order, especially for a show that's heavily serialized. It was like we were deliberately trying to make life as hard for ourselves as possible.
So these scripts got sent to us, emailed to us for this episode, as a lot of us were in chauffeur-driven SUVs on our way down to San Diego for Comic-Con.
Oh,
and
right.
I can remember I'm in the back of a Navigator bawling. And texting with Darcy saying, like, have you read this? And she texted, like, oh my God, Chidi. And it was just the heaviest thing in the world.
People cried during the read through.
I want to talk about the table read.
You know, just,
oh, yeah. Are you talking? I mean, you're referring to me.
Yes.
I was bawling.
Yeah.
I was going to deal with this later, but we may as well talk about it right now. We were in the writer's room having the read through of this episode, and we started it, and it was a very somber thing. It was a very well-attended table read, probably owing to the fact that it's a season finale, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it got so meaningful and sad. This is a comedy, Mike.
What?
Yeah.
You're kidding.
No. Half hours as a rule.
No.
Yeah. Our comedies.
Well, here's the thing. We had this idea of how we could end the year, and it was one of those... In the episode, as Chidi begins to suggest this plan to erase his memory in order to not, so that he won't blow it, so that Simone won't figure something out, or, you know, he says she's very perceptive. I might screw up. And he correctly points out that the stakes of this are like, he's like, it's not just it's bad if I run into my ex, it'll be awkward. It's like, if I'm awkward around my ex, every human being in history gets tortured forever. Like, we can't risk it. It's a sacrifice that he realizes he has to make in order to for the greater good. And Eleanor and Michael, their reaction is first like, no, we'll figure something else out, right? We got another plan. Eleanor pitches a plan. Michael says, well, he can't do that. He can't selectively erase memories. We'll keep thinking. And then later, you know, even after they've decided to do it, Michael has his idea. It's my favorite Ted Danson moment of the episode. It's like, let's have an old-fashioned brainstorming session. And, you know, we'll get some Chinese food and throw pencils into the ceiling. And someone will say something innocuous. And I'll say, wait, say that again. Like human foible that he desires to experience is one of my favorites.
Ted and I were just talking about that a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And it's such a great thing because, frankly, you've done that move elsewhere in the show.
Sure.
Where he goes, Janet, that's it.
Yeah. Or to Tahani, like, right.
Right.
So, but that sort of process of Eleanor and Michael and everybody else at first thinking that there was another path and then slowly having it dawn on them that there wasn't is a little bit of a mirror for what happened to me. I'll say, I won't speak for all the writers, but when the idea was pitched and we started going down this path, my first thought was like, well, that's really cool, but it's very sad. And there's another, we'll come up with something else that isn't quite as sad. But as we talked about different options, like it just became clear that this was the right option. And it slowly washed over me. And I will say us, that this was what we kind of had to do, that it was the right creative decision, and it was a bummer. I mean, it really is, like, it's very sad.
It's a beautiful bummer.
Thank you, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the feeling that I remember having, is it sort of was like, oh no, I think this is what we have to do. I think this is the right move. The sort of way I thought of it was like, all right, well, the season one finale was a huge risk in for many reasons, right? This gigantic sort of world upending thing. And the season two finale was also a giant creative risk because, like, sending them back to Earth seemed scary and
moving, oh, yeah,
right? And yeah. So I was like, well, this is the same thing. It's just a different kind of risk. It's not everything you've learned is fake, but it is, the tone of the show takes a decided sort of left turn into like real maudlin.
Human, not human,
yeah,
human, not maudlin.
But
you don't dwell.
I guess I'm using those things interchangeably, I would say. Like that maudlin, the reality of relationships and of life is that there are periods of very sad
maudlin,
just maudlin moments, right? Yeah. And so I was sort of like, well, that we're trying to tell a story of what it means to be a good person. And part of being a good person is dealing with the inevitable sort of sadnesses that come up in your life. So we just sort of committed to it.
Ted is
you really earned the right because you've developed that couple as somebody you really root for. It really has become an old-fashioned romantic.
Well, that was the key. The key was once we knew where we were going, we backed up a couple episodes and we thought, okay, well, there's this wonderful moment we had already talked about in the Janet's episode where Chidi kind of, Ted just spilled coffee on himself.
But it woke me up. I'm here. Hi. What do you want to talk about?
He's wearing a white button-down shirt, a beautiful, well-tailored white button-down shirt, and now there's a gigantic coffee stain on the front.
Which is me.
That's the perfect comedy move. Yeah. So we went back and we were like, well, okay, the way to make this really hit hard is to just have them live, have that moment at the end of the Janet's episode lead to like a couple episodes of just real bliss, right?
I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah, like real, like they're just happy. Chidi shifts into this different mode where he's sort of like, you know, less indecisive, and he's very clear about, you know, in the episode after the Janet's when they're in the postal office, he's very, very content and very sort of straightforwardly happy, and they have a lovely date, and they're just very much, and they casually say I love you and stuff like that, and it was like, it's like a horror movie where you think when you watch those episodes now, it's like what we were just playing you.
Right? Oh yeah. It was like, this part does seem particularly cruel.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the Janet's episode, you lay down in black ink. The key to this all is memories. Remember who you are.
That's right.
And then 20 seconds later, you're like, bye.
Goodbye memories.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's very sad, but it was the right move. I still, you know,
and it's kind of the ultimate of taking people who were kind of you were intellectually involved with in the first season, and then you got more and more, and then Michael becomes more human and wants to, everything is going towards heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and you just did the biggest of all heart aches.
Was the idea. Yeah. Was like this, we've done a lot of pyrotechnics and stuff this season, right? Mm-hmm. The interdimensional hole of pancakes and the Janet's episode and stuff. And a lot of like giant kind of crazy fun swings. And it felt like the right ending isn't another giant crazy, there's an alien, you know, portal that leads to another dimension. It felt like it was like, oh, this relationship needs a problem. And this guy who's deeply invested in the lives of these four humans needs to do something very human and expressive to show that he cares about them. And those seemed like the big, ironically, those little swings seemed like the bigger swings at the end of the year.
So Mike, we meet the character of John Wheaton. Is the name Wheaton significant?
No, okay. It was a simple, we wanted it to be a simple name that didn't suggest anything like in particular.
So it's definitely named after the Christian college outside of Chicago.
That's right. Okay. I'm sorry. I should have said that. Yes. It's
we learned that this was not random, and that the humans and Michael and Janet's worst fears weren't confirmed, in the sense that they were thinking that Sean was going to send axe murderers and, you know, and terrible, terrible people. He did, just in a different form. They've sent a person uniquely suited to get under the skin of each of these four humans.
Yes, Sean, the idea here is that Sean figured out that the way to try to not guarantee victory, but at least to skew their end result in their favor, is to sort of smart bomb it, right? It's like, mm-hmm. you send in people who are going to just screw up the four people who are the best suited to help these new people. Mm-hmm. And if you can make their lives miserable, they will be less likely to help the new people, which will help guarantee a bad place win. So yes, and we only see two of them in this finale. There's two as yet named that we'll meet in season four. But it's
I wondered about that. Yes. So you had ones delineated for Jason and for
we had Omar? Ideas for them, yeah. But we didn't set. We're back at work now in season four. We didn't settle on them until now.
Wow.
But yeah, John is Tahani's because he was just a sort of, he just drove her crazy in an online gossipy kind of a way and commenting on her body and body shaming her and stuff like that.
Sister shaming her.
There you go. And then also, Simone obviously was the person for Chidi, because that just utterly debilitates him.
It's amazing. It's interesting. You planted another seed in the boardroom in the previous episode. He invokes Simone. So it's a nice little reminder of like, oh, that's right. This person that, you know, the beginning of the season feels like years ago somehow. Australia feels like years ago.
Yeah, we were terrified to do it too many times. We wanted to do it at least once. We had Simone in one of her episodes say, this is what you do. You repeat the experiment and you double check the results. It's the one where they're in the Tahani's house after Tahani's been engaged. She says, like, our next step will be to repeat the experiment. And so we lay that in. We wanted to have someone bring it up at least once just to remind people about that Simone existed. But it's a fine line. If we thought, like, if we keep mentioning Simone, people might see it coming.
People are going to be like, here comes Simone.
Here comes Simone. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Interestingly, we were talking with Need Noggle, who was on the podcast, I guess, last week. And I said, hey, when you get a chance, you know, I'm hoping it's done and that we get a chance to see the finale soon. He's like, are you kidding? I've been like, that had nothing of me in it.
Yeah.
By comparison, that's been done for weeks.
Yeah. I will say that he did one thing I want to specifically shout out, which is in the movie that Michael plays for Chidi and Eleanor, of their memories, some of which we've seen in previous episodes and some of which we haven't.
Mm-hmm.
There's the moment where the two of them are on a boat and they're just reading poetry and drinking wine and having this like sort of lover's afternoon. And the water where they were in that boat was kind of murky and gross.
Mm.
And he had done an enormous amount of work to the background.
There's a mountain.
There's a mountain and there's a beautiful sort of, I don't know, weeping willow or spruce tree or something mm-hmm. over on the right-hand side of the screen, off the bank of the little pond. And it's a beautiful shot. But the water was still just kind of like murky. It looked like there was a little like oil slick or something.
Okay.
Because it was just kind of gross water. And I had said...
Oh, Los Angeles.
I had said to him at some point, like, is there anything you can do? And he was like, look, water is really tricky. It's not, you know... And I was like, I get it. I mean, he was like killing himself to get the episode 12 done. And so we looked at the final shot and he was working from home. And I said, God, it's so beautiful, except for that one like weird, murky, gross oil slick. And I called him and said, like, I know, man, I know you're about to murder me and then yourself. But if there's anything you can do to just, I don't know. And he was like, let me see what I can do. And then like 12 hours later, he sent me a new shot that looks perfectly pristine. Like it's like a perfect alpine lake.
So much so that I had a question listed for later of, is that a famous painting that you recreated? Because it's familiar somehow.
Yeah.
It resonates.
Well, the actual architecture, the sort of natural architecture of the little pond where we shot it suggested, like it was beautifully framed the way a painting is. There are trees on the right, except they were palm trees. So we switched them out for whatever those are. And there were trees on the left, which he also switched out. And then he put the mountain in back. And it has the feeling of like, it looks like an oil painting.
It does.
It's not. It's dead David Neednagle original and mixed with the natural geography of that little lake, the pond where we shot it.
One thing I do want to mention about that table read was that it was unlike anything I've ever attended and that we all got emotional. Darcy, I think, was the first to go. She would hold and there was silence in that room. And then I think I was having difficulty. What was happening is that Darcy was saying her lines to Kristen's character, to Eleanor, and having to just stop and to regain her composure and then continue. And I then began crying. Then Jamila began crying. And then I look, you know, like looking for to take my brain away, I looked out into the crowd and there were lots of people crying, up to and including like at the end, we finished and a network executive stood up and was in tears and said, like, thank you for this show. This is a special show. And in true Ted Danson fashion, like, you were moved as well. And then on the stairs on the way down to the van, you were like, season four. That just bought us season four. Do you remember that?
No.
What's so fun about this has been there's two non-human characters, and at the end of this season, they're both, like, doing incredibly human things. That was the we worked backwards a little bit in the breaking of the story from like we knew the thing at the beginning that was going to happen that was human, which is that he was going to suddenly feel intense pressure and be overwhelmed and have a panic attack. Like that we knew early on, but we were like, well, it should end with him doing something human and where he's regained his composure. And so we started calling it the Cinema Paradiso moment, right? I love that movie. I hadn't seen it in years. It's wonderful. It's so wonderful. And I rewatched it and it totally holds up. So we were like, well, that, if you want Michael to do a human thing at the end that is comforting, that what's a better thing he could do than say, like, I know that your friend has to go on a long journey, so I'm going to show you a scrapbook of some of the nice memories that you've had.
Yeah.
And also doing it in a way where he's not running the show, right? Like they're having their private moment. He steps in and sort of nicely says, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I made you something. And then he just recedes. He steps away. For a guy who was like a control freak and who was like manipulating everybody and controlling this neighborhood and everything, we thought it was as important that he recede in that moment. That act of just like stepping back is almost as important as the actual thing that he did of making that sort of visual scrapbook for them.
And very hard to act.
Was it?
The receding. Not my go-to.
To do it authentically, like a person who wants to step away from the camera. Your best work yet, sir. That's interesting, though. We talked about the panic attack at the beginning. That was that took us a long time to figure out what was happening there, because we didn't want it to seem fake. And then I remembered the conversation that you and I had very like before we were shooting the pilot about middle management. About it, this guy was middle management.
That was such a great line.
Yeah. That was the thing that when it finally clicked for us was like, if you really drill down into what has happened, like we know this guy is this sort of like, you know, immortal demon who's been a puppet master, but that's not really who he is. He was a kind of a, like a middle manager who had one idea and we love the idea of it over suddenly. Like him remembering that almost, like, oh, I'm not meant for any of this. Like,
I'm way out on a limb here.
Way out on a limb. And it's such a funny, that's my favorite visual Ted Danson moment of the episode is when Eleanor is like, you're going to pick yourself up and you're going to pull up your bootstraps and you're going to march out there. And you do this little thing with your hands where you give a like, yeah, keep going sign to her. Like, just like, yeah, this is good. This is good. Keep coming. And then she finishes and you just stare at her with a very dumb smile on your face. And then it smash cuts to her doing what she just told you to do. It's a really wonderful, like, it. She just looked at you and was like, oh, this didn't work at all.
Yeah. It's really lovely to see you regain composure because you are so low. Like at one point, you're literally writhing. It reminds me of an early viral video of a woman getting very hurt and saying like, no.
Oh, the grapes?
The grapes woman. Yeah, the grapes. Was that a reference for you?
Yes, I remember that well. I hated that video because...
I hated it too.
I don't like videos or any video evidence on a TV show, a reality show of like human misery.
Yeah.
Where everyone's going, ha, ha, look at that woman who's in pain.
Yeah. Oh, I think you're just tempting the universe for that very thing to happen to you soon.
I have a very low tolerance. I'm very squeamish about
pranks,
this stuff.
Oh,
pranks are the worst in the world.
That's bad place stuff.
Yeah, it really is. Yes. I hate pranks more than anything in the world, I think. It's so unfair to make someone believe that something bad is happening and then go, ha ha, surprise, I was just kidding.
And then convince them somehow to sign off on it so that humiliation.
Because you've trapped them, right? Because it's like now if you don't sign off, you're the bad sport.
So Michael finally relents and says, I'll give you a few minutes to say goodbye. It's going to take me a few minutes to get the snappy, snappy, wipey, wipey together. And it's nighttime in town square. The chairs are set up. They're the only two there. Are they sitting where they're sitting because that's where they were sitting when Eleanor confessed? Are those the very seats?
No. Okay. That was in the, as you're looking from where Michael would stand on the stage or someone would stand on the stage. In that scene, they're on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. This one, they're on the left-hand side.
Okay.
They were sitting there because we wanted them to look back at the movie into the town, into the empty town. Okay. So, but also, after watching Cinema Paradiso, I had a thought that many great directors have. Which is, ooh, I'm going to steal those shots. That's the essence of great directing. And so I just positioned them in a way that I could get certain angles back on their faces and over their shoulders, the way that the character in Cinema Paradiso at the end is watching his collection, his movie montage.
So Michael has this gift and he plays a video for them. What's the title of it? Is it Memories You Might
Some Have? Memories You Might Have Forgotten, I think is what we landed on, I think.
Because obviously they've been rebooted and some of these are literally things that they would not have remembered.
Yeah. And it was also, we didn't have that in the script to begin with, that we added that in editing because I thought the feedback from a couple of the writers who had watched the cut was that it wasn't entirely clear that these weren't all, people were worried that the audience would think, I don't remember this either. Mm-hmm. Because some of them they didn't remember. There were new things that we shot. But then, and I was sort of into that idea. There was something interesting and sort of meta about the idea of presenting memories of these two people that were also had been quote unquote forgotten by the audience in some way. And then I was like, get out of your own ass, man. Just stop. You're not equipped for this. Just make it clear that you're not supposed to remember all of these things.
Right.
And it'll play as a more effective scene, I think.
And it works because it's so like, we see them in the 50s garb going to on the train on the way to the Museum of Human Suffering or whatever. So there are these touchstones to things that we know. There are things that seem new.
The one where she rushes up and kisses him as he's erasing the chalkboard was new. Mm-hmm. A lot of the fighting was new. There was the scene where they were fighting on the train, but we shot like them fighting at three or four more points in the neighborhood because I was sort of like, well, if Michael was telling the true story of a true relationship that had many dimensions over many hundreds of years, some of that's going to be they're screaming at each other. Like,
sure.
That just has to be the case. So we fought them. We walked all over the neighborhood in all these different nooks and crannies and had them just yell at each other. And it was wonderful. It was such a fun thing. We didn't roll sound on it intentionally because I didn't want to be tempted to use the sound.
That's smart. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, so we didn't roll sound on it, but the two of them just improvised fighting. We would come up with scenarios. I would say, okay, this scenario is Chidi's furious at you because you promised him you would do something and then you flaked and didn't do it and you're being defensive and saying it's not my fault and because of these other reasons. And
now let's not roll audio.
Right, exactly. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful just to see those two people improvise fights and improvise cute date chatter, like when they're at a restaurant. We shot them kissing 7 or 8 times, and it was like
there's a lot of fighting, there's a lot of hugging, and there's a lot of kissing.
There's a lot of cute.
There's mundane kissing. There's meaningful kissing.
That was we did the same thing for the kissing. It was like okay, this scenario, like the one, my favorite kiss is in the alley. When they're sort of standing there and she kind of leans up and kisses him and he kind of reacts awkwardly and puts his hands in his pockets and she kind of like goes up on her tiptoes with a little coy look on her face like, yep, I just did that.
Yeah.
And that scenario was something like, this is like early on in one of the reboots and you're happy because you just did something good for the first time. Like, for example, the in the episode where she lets someone cut in front of her in line eating frozen yogurt. Mm-hmm. And you just had a great day. You were just happy because you feel like you're making progress. And you finished a lesson and you decided to walk him back to his apartment, which is in this alley, because he hasn't moved in with you yet. And he says goodnight and then you just decide, I'm just going to do this. And you just kiss him.
They are old time movie stars in this television show we're doing. They're because of how you set it up and how you want them to come together. And then it just to me is like, wow, I'm looking at two movie stars fall in love in an old time film. That kind of acting, and it's so good. You really earn the right to so desperately want them to fall in love. And then when you take that away, I just think it's brilliant. Anyway, I'm singing their praises, not yours at the moment. I think they did an amazing job at being movie stars.
I 100% agree. I would say that part of the inspiration to make it a black and white kind of, you know, old timey introduction to that montage was exactly that like their romance and their relationship feels timeless to me at least.
Yeah.
That was the reason that Cinema Paradiso is sort of the right model for that ending. The other thing I'll say, and I hope I'm not betraying Kristen's confidence by saying this, I don't think there's any.
She's leaving Dax for Will Hartman.
Yeah, I'm definitely. Now that I think about it, I'm definitely betraying her confidence. We auditioned a number of excellent actors to play Chidi, and we did chemistry reads with Kristen. We wrote a couple scenes and we had Kristen come in and we read with all of them. And they were all great. They really were great. And it was one of those moments where you feel like, wow, not only it's both an embarrassment of riches and also it is you're full of fear, because if there's one very clear choice, you go, well, that's the clear choice. And if something goes wrong later down the line, it's like, well, that was the clear choice. When it's not a clear choice, I feel the stress a lot more. So we were discussing afterwards with Kristen about the men that she had read with. And she agreed that they were all really good. They were all funny and they were charming and they were winning actors and everything was good. But she said, there's just something about Will Harper though. Like it's like, she's like, there's just this thing that some people have where like, you can't define it. You don't know what it is. You don't, it's any word that you'd use to describe it falls flat of accurately describing it. It's just a quality about an actor that is like, it's what people mean when they say things like it, or like he has it, or she has it, or whatever. And she was like, she's like, they're all really great. They'd all be great. He has that thing, whatever that thing is. And that's how we had felt when we first saw him on tape from New York. And so when she said that, I was kind of like, well, if she's feeling that, Kristen Bell, she's been doing this for a while now. She knows
she should stick with it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And so that kind of sealed it. Like her defining his indefinable quality as an actor kind of like put us over the top with him.
And that's what, you know, it's like, let the creative person who's going to be opposite him tell you what is real.
Someone else that I forget who, someone else gave me a piece of advice about hiring writers once. And the piece of advice was very simple. It was like, you're going to read a lot of scripts, sample scripts, and you're not looking for the perfect piece of writing. No one's ever been written, right? Don't get discouraged by the parts of those scripts you don't like. If someone writes a script and there are two things in it, two jokes, two lines, two moments that make you laugh out loud or that you didn't see coming or whatever, that's the person you hire. It's such a simple piece of advice, but it's so good. It's such a good piece of advice because it's like what you're looking for at some level is uniqueness and inspiration. And the same is true for writers, for actors, for any creative endeavor. like a property master or a costumer or a line producer or anybody who's involved with the creative process, if that person has a certain like indefinable quality that you're just magnetically attracted to, or does things that are just bursts of inspiration, that's the person you hire.
Watching this montage, at a certain point, you take these two movie stars and you have Kristen's head on Will's shoulder, and we just watch them feel, and it's remarkable. What were they watching on set? What was there anything for reference? How did you...
They were watching nothing, which makes it even more remarkable.
That's unbelievable.
Kristen asked me to read aloud the stage directions of what was in the montage, which we had written into the script. We had written a bunch of... because we had to shoot them, a lot of them, right?
Right.
So I stood 20 feet away from them and quietly read aloud the montage, and they stared at nothing and pretended to see it. And that's what acting is. That's why it's amazing.
It would seem, if we could transport the audience listening now to that set, it would seem so cold and clinical and dry, right? Like, yeah. And for Will, and especially for Kristen, to elicit that performance based on Mike Schur reading off 8.5 by 11 paper. I mean, that's insane.
It is.
But this is how I'm going next year. I have a little earwick, and Mike's just going to say bigger, smaller, faster, faster.
Ted's going full Brando next year. Just tell me what to do. Just give me line readings.
Full episodes of The Good Place are available on NBC.com and the NBC app. Let's listen to a clip.
I don't normally cry at movies, but that one was pretty good. That girl was hot. The guy was too.
I'm gonna miss you so much, Eleanor.
Except you won't. That's what's so scary about this whole thing. I'm gonna miss you. You're just gonna think I'm some sexy godlike figure who you wanna hump immediately after meeting her.
I know you're deflecting by making jokes about how hot
you are. It's not a joke. I'm a legit snack.
But I believe in you. I am not even scared to get rebooted because I know that you'll be here taking care of me.
I wish we had more time together.
Oh, time means nothing. Jeremy, bear me, baby. We'll get through this, and then you and I can chill out in the dot of the eye forever.
Right. We'll be okay. We found each other before hundreds of times. We can do it again. By cheating.
Man, Shevitz, the fact that you have earned the right to make that one of the most beautiful scenes on film ever. It is such a romantic, astounding scene.
Yeah,
Mike.
A couple things are going on there. Again, that's the two of them being amazing. But Megan and Jen writing that scene, to be able to conceive of and execute the joke, it's not a joke, I'm a legit snack. And then for Kristen to deliver it as well as she does, it's the most like value added you can imagine, because they're being so good and the scene is so sad and it's so important. And then somehow they wrote that joke and Kristen acted it and it didn't destroy the scene. Like it should, a joke in that moment should blow up the scene.
It should take you out of it.
It should take you out of it. And yet it doesn't. Kristen has created a character who is so indelible and so consistent in her particular, like the way that she thinks of herself, that she's able to pull that off while like through tears. She's literally crying about how she's a legit snack in that moment. And that's one of the craziest high wire acts I've ever seen. Yeah. I could not believe she pulled that off.
That's one of her fortes, man.
Yeah.
She can do, even in a comedic moment, do a triple take without...
It's like doing a figure skating routine and in the middle of like a triple axel, also like cooking a souffle or something. You know what I mean? Like you shouldn't be able to do both of those things at the same time.
But the poignancy of being around somebody who you're madly in love and know that that person doesn't recognize you is one of those things that the world is dealing with in life, you know? And I find it incredibly moving and beautifully written.
Yeah, I will say that, first of all, a large share of the credit here goes to Megan Amram and Jen Statsky, who wrote the script. That scene of Janet talking to Eleanor and saying, being angry at the universe in the way that people get angry at the universe justifiably when tragedy befalls them, It's a very identifiable feeling. Also, side note, Kristen acts the
fork
out of that scene. She's so good in like this barely controlled anger that she's smiling through.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene where Janet says, I get it, I know how you feel. And you have to just sort of believe at some level that there's meaning here.
Mm-hmm.
Those words, if you think about it, are being spoken by a non-human entity to a human who has been through extraordinary circumstances, obviously. But Darcy also delivers those lines in such a straightforward, kind of beautiful, simplistic human way. Not simplistic, simple.
Mm-hmm.
I say all of this just to say that scene was very sketchily laid out in the outline.
Is that right?
Yeah. This is a technique Greg Daniels used to do at The Office that I always sort of admired, is when there was a really big, emotional, kind of intense human scene, he didn't like to get super specific and break it all down and say, then this person says this and this person says this or whatever. He believed in his guts that there was real value in saying, here's what this scene has to accomplish. And then sort of turning it over to a writer and saying, try, give it a shot. And put this through your own writer filter and see what happens. And then if we don't like it, we'll write something else. And it's a very lovely thing to do as a showrunner, because it's very trusting and it's a huge vote of confidence. Also, having been on the other side of it as a writer who worked for him, it's terrifying because you're like, no, you're better at me than this. Just tell me what to write and I'll write it. I'll execute your idea.
Right.
But he did that at The Office all the time, and it really was great. It really worked a lot in very key big moments. He did it with Steve Carell in the season 2 finale, the famous episode, the Casino Night episode where Jim comes back in and kisses Pam. He didn't tell Steve what to write. He just said, this is the scene. Pam is on the phone with her mom, and Jim just comes in and kisses her. That was all that scene was. And then Steve interpreted that the way that he thought it should go. And we filmed that scene, and it's like the most famous scene in the history of the show. And so we sort of did the same thing. I was sort of like, look, this is what this has to be, right? Eleanor is miserable and she calls Janet to comfort her, which I think is what she would do in that moment, because
it's comfort, but it's also like,
it's anger.
I quit. Like, tell me, I'm going to flip to the back of the book and look at the answer key.
Well,
I'm done.
She's lashing out, right? Because it's like, why did this horrible fate befall me? Which is like, again, it's the most relatable thing in the world. When something bad happens to you or a loved one, you want to fall to your knees and shake your fist at the sky. And so Janet is the sky, right? Janet's like, well, you know everything. Tell me why this happened. And Megan and Jen, I don't know which one of them wrote that scene, or I didn't ask. I assume both of them had input. Whoever it was, or however it came out, it was just, we didn't change a word of it, I don't think. It was really their interpretation of that scene was so great.
I think you bring up this really interesting part of the creative process, which is, you know, if an actor asks somebody to write something for him, or Greg Daniels would say, I want you to write it this way, you've cut out an entire part of the creative process by saying, I want to know what you think. Let me see it come from you.
Right.
Then you get this emotional, authentic truth more often than not. It's so smart.
I think so too. And I also think that the lovely thing about it is it's what it's saying is there isn't one right way to do this.
Right.
If I had Joe Mandy write that scene, it also would have been great, and it would have been entirely different. It would have felt different.
Right.
It would
have
been filthy. That's right. We would have had to remove a lot of cursing. But it
would have been authentic.
It would have been authentic. Yes, that's right. And if I had asked anyone to do it on the staff, I think they're all great writers, and I think they all could have written a great scene.
Released them from having to guess what you would write.
And because also, I don't know what it is. I don't know what the right answer is. Nobody does. And so it's a
so
very
smart,
trusting thing that I learned from Greg to say, I believe that there is something that you specifically in your voice will create something interesting. Yeah. Let's give it a shot. And we can always change it. Greg used to also say, this is a first draft. It's not going on TV. We have plenty of opportunities to look at it and analyze it and whatever. He just believed in the sort of unfettered attempt by the writer, which I think is a cool move.
Brilliant. Yeah. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
The day I met you and you were talking about the show before it all started, That's one of the things that just knocked me out was you'd go, I don't know, I haven't figured that out. If I asked a question,
yeah.
It was so real. What, there was no BS in anything you said. It was just...
Because 9 times out of 10, people go, yeah. Oh, yes.
Yes. Wow.
Super thought of that.
Your head.
Glad you asked. In fact, yeah. I am not stalling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not stalling.
I just, 1 second, I need to tie my shoe and then I'll tell you the definite answer that
okay,
I have.
So season two is... Yeah. I mean, that's a brand of defensive... egotism that doesn't allow you to go, oh, you're right. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, that's the Greg Daniels way. I'll continue to say this until I am drummed out of show business. I don't micromanage Kirsten Mann's costumes or Gabe Pirello's props or Ted Danson's acting or Megan Amram's writing, because I believe that the reason that you work with those people is because you want them to do their thing, right? And like, again, in that scene, there was nothing about pandemonium or Paradise Lost or anything in the outline. I learned that Milton called the center of hell pandemonium, meaning place of all demons, from the script that was turned in. I didn't know that. I was like, wow, that's cool.
So wait, was the title Pandemonium?
No, we then changed the title to Pandemonium.
What had it been prior?
Paradise Lost.
honestly, I don't remember, but I was like, wow, what a wonderful thing that they use their own knowledge mm-hmm. and their own writing abilities to like link this thing that you have to embrace the pandemonium. It's such a beautiful idea. Also, it's a wonderful joke. I don't know if it's Megan or Jen. It mm-hmm. kind of sounds like Jen to me, but the joke about how Chidi tricked her into reading it by telling her that Satan was her type.
Right.
She's a big, mean, bald guy with a goatee, you know.
Which is on brand.
On brand, very on brand for
this
her.
This is yet another moment of smartest, dumbest show on television.
But yeah, I was like, I mean, again, if we had like workshopped that scene and the dialogue into the ground before sending those two women off to write the script, we wouldn't have gotten that.
And you would have beat it to death.
Yeah, exactly. And it might have still been good, but it wouldn't have had that. That was a true kind of writerly spark of inspiration that they, again, I don't know which one of them did it, but that linked their own knowledge or understanding of a great work of literature to this specific moment for this specific character. And then that became literally so fundamental to the episode that it's the title of the finale.
And it's what makes people want to work with you and Greg, because you are now called upon to use your creativity and not just regurgitate someone else's thoughts. And it's very satisfying as an, you know, creative soul.
I thank you. I hope that's true. And also, why in the world would you do it any other way? What is the point of hiring a writing staff and then just telling them what to do? It's boring.
I don't know, but I work on lots of shows and that is the norm. that is how it often
you
works.
You used to work on a lot of shows.
They're welcome to fire me. This scene is so meaningful. This is the scene that in the table read brought the room to its knees. And it occurs to me, Mike, that you guys foreshadowed this a little bit in what was a throwaway bit in, I think, the episode in the accountant's office. Janet glitches and a song comes out of her mouth and it's, "Do you believe in life after love?" You're a monster, dude. That's so mean. That's obviously a direct connect, right?
It's not at all.
That's not true.
It's not. Josh and Dylan wrote that script, and it was just funny to imagine her belching and then it being auto-tuned and then her singing that song. In no way, shape, or form were we attempting to connect that lyric to the end of the season, I can promise you.
I don't buy it.
I do think it's funny. This is a side note, as long as we're talking about this. It is wonderful to read about or hear about theories of how we have so brilliantly planted certain things in certain episodes back in season one that mm-hmm. are not paying off today. And some of them are correct. Other times it's insane. But there's a great joy in having created something that people are looking for connections in.
But that also happens because you're leading a purposeful, creative life here on this show. So those things happen more often than not.
I think you're right. I think there is a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy to it. There's also an actual self-fulfilling prophecy, which is that as we develop these episodes, we are actively combing back through ideas and things that have aired in the show to say, can we link something up here, right? One of them being, and I think you talked about this with Mandzukas in the last episode, in the episode where Michael's taking the crew to the bad place in season two, It was a total joke that there's an IHOP in the neutral zone. And then Jason says, oh, dope, I'm going to get some pancakes or whatever. And he goes, no, this is the interdimensional hole of pancakes. You don't eat these pancakes. It's more like the pancakes eat you. That was the joke. It was a pure throwaway joke. But then as the years go on, as the season goes on, and we need a location or an interesting place to go that we haven't seen yet, it's like, well, we did say there's a thing called the interdimensional hall of pancakes.
Amazing.
Might as well go there. Like, why not? Right. So sometimes it's things like that, and sometimes it's made up. But the best thing is, so I went to this National Association of Sartre Scholars annual convention. I don't know. Did we talk about this?
When was this? No, what are you talking about?
So I got an email a while ago.
When? Sorry.
I mean, I went in July, I want to say. So I got an email, I don't know, from a professor who is, I believe, the directors of the NASS. You guys all know what that is.
Sure.
The National Association of Sartre Scholars. And he and his wife liked the show. And we had done the existentialism episode where Michael had an existential crisis. And he wanted to know if I would attend the conference, which was in D.C. area. University of Mary Washington is where it was. And so he was, would you come to the conference? And we will put out a call for papers to the Sartre scholars, and we'll write papers about the show. And I immediately, yes, absolutely.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
And so I went, Todd May and I went together. I suggested to him, Todd May happens to actually be an actual French existentialism scholar of sorts. And so I was like, this is going to go a lot better if you have a guy there who knows what he's talking
about.
So Todd came, and it was really fun. And we hung out at this university, and people presented three papers about the show. It was delightful. I gave a little speech about the show and what we've learned about existentialism, and it was delightful from beginning to end. But this is all a long-winded way of saying that in one of the papers, one of the junior faculty members was talking about the show, and apparently in a Sartre work, Sartre, it's like a diary entry, and there's an entry that's a kind of famous entry in the world of Sartre scholarship, which is Sartre wrote like something like Tuesday, period, nothing, period, nauseous, period, or something.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman was absolutely 100% convinced that the reason in the Jeremy Baramy episode that Michael, when asked what the dot is over the eye, Michael says that's Tuesdays and also July. He was 100% convinced that that was not a coincidence, that the reason that the eye and over the dot over the eye in Baramy,
not Monday, not Wednesday,
Tuesdays, was because we were linking it to this very specific entry from a Sartre diary entry that I had never read in my life. And I didn't want to disabuse him of that notion, because what a wonderful thing that that moment, that throwaway joke, again, that I think Megan Amram wrote, was seen in this incredibly meaningful context by a man who was spending his life studying French existentialism.
That's amazing.
It's wonderful, yeah.
I think the universe likes to jump in on things that are purposeful. I really do, and help out.
But you know, existentialism brings up the notion of, like, what's the point? And that's what Janet and Eleanor are talking about here. And Janet basically says, like, look, if it weren't hard, why would you do it? Like, connection with anyone is so unlikely that when it happens, it's special. It's euphoria. It's, you know, that's the point. And that's what makes life worth living. Because I think that it's Eleanor that has said, like, otherwise the universe is just made of pain and I can't go there. I can't think about that.
Yeah.
Darcy does a thing. You did lots of takes, and I'm curious if this was your direction or something she did on her own, but she brought Video Village to tears on the take where she says, we'll do this together, in the words of the man I love. And then in a very Manny Jacinto way, she purses her lips and moves them to the side and says, I got you, dog.
Yeah.
And that embodiment, which is a little, you know, a little throwback to the Janet's episode where she's playing all these people, but it was so tiny and so delicious and meaningful. Like, she's showing her not a girl, not a robot, human love for this dude, but also empathizing and sharing it and gifting it on her friend, Eleanor. I mean, it was just an incredible moment.
It's a great moment. And it's not, I did not tell her to do that, or instruct her to do that in any way. She just did that. And so the reason that moment I think is so impactful is because she has done there's been no adornment. There's no light bells and whistles to her performance in that scene. It's incredibly small and calm and reassuring and human. And so the tiny little inflection that she gives as a little mini Jason impression of sorts.
Right.
Is incredibly like it kind of like you it's like a defibrillator. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And it's also very charming because she's very charming and Manny is very charming. So when she did that, it took my breath away because I was like, oh my God, what a great idea.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that.
She did it smartly too. I mean, sometimes as actors, we're like, oh, I have an idea of something I'd like to try. I'm going to save it until we're on my close up or on a single or whatever, rather than do it in the wide and have it not mean anything 40 minutes.
Why
from
are
now.
You looking at me?
I've seen you. Obvious? I've learned from you, and I'm going to steal it forever.
I take it from what you're saying that you mean to imply that Darcy Carden is a good actor. Is that what you're saying? Do I understand you?
I think she should still stick it out.
Right. She should keep going. She shouldn't quit.
I don't think she should move home yet.
My bit with her has been, as I've spent time with her in the aftermath of the Janet's episode, a large number of people will come up to her and say, oh my God, you were so great. That episode was so great. You're so great. You're so great. And my bit is just to go like, she was fine. Okay. Let's like cool it. It's like, it was a solid B, but let's not go over the top.
Something like the second episode of the first year, I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, poor Darcy. All she's going to do is this robot bit. You know, she's going to get so bored. Poor Darcy.
Yeah.
I texted her the other day with this in mind because I was rewatching Book of Dougs. And it is so crazy. You're in the good place. You're in the mail depot. And I wrote to her and I said, it's super
forking
remarkable that watching you as Janet, having difficulty emulating a neutral Janet is as funny as it is because it's your creation and performance of neutral Janet that's so great and real and neutral that it legitimately feels like it's a different person or a character or actor. That should not work.
Right.
But to see her go, it's nice to be here. Oh,
I mean, it's not nice to be not here or whatever. Yeah.
But the neutral Janet is so different.
Yeah.
But you guys, it's her. It's Darcy Carden. We know her.
Again, you're saying she should stick it out.
I mean, it's incredible.
Just give it another 6 months and then
go away tables.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you should stick it out too, Mark, because when I just heard you read a text with complete bright sentences with periods and complete punctuation, no one texts like that.
You
should definitely do podcasts, man, because you are.
Bigger picture, Mike, like, I'm not going to ask you to spoil season 4, but like...
Spoil it.
You've done it. Like, this is permanent. You've put Eleanor and the humans and even Michael and Janet into a position where the known reality is once again completely upset. You've almost put Eleanor into a Doug Forsett position of, you know, how can she be in these reboots organic and natural? She knows she knows the truth.
Right. Well, Eleanor, as she says in the finale, she says, look, I became such a good person, I almost forgot. I'm a world-class liar, baby.
Super fun thing to hear from your girlfriend.
That was intentional. We put that in intentionally because her entire life is about to be a series of lies to people that she loves for the sake of maintaining this illusion. And so we wanted to remind her and the audience that that is the case. But at some level, again, we're trying to investigate what it just means to be alive on Earth and how you function and how you get through the day. And a huge part of that is just dealing with personal sadness and difficulty and tragedy. It's the thing that Eleanor says to Michael in the existential crisis episode. We're all a little bit sad all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, that's a pretty crappy deal. And she says, yeah, it is, but we're not offered another one. And so even the idea here is even in the afterlife, like, it's not different. There are still people and they have relationships, they have friendships, things are sad, they get rebooted, they forget stuff, they treat each other badly and feel awful about it, they make it up to each other, like they're still poking around and trying to figure out how to just navigate being alive in whatever it even means to say that they're alive. And so, yeah, it's deeply sad. It's a very, very sad finale.
It feels like a funeral.
Yeah.
Worse than a funeral because that person's still there.
That's right. It's this is a little bit of an anecdote here, but do you know the story of Sandra Day O'Connor and her husband?
A little bit.
Yeah. Sandra Day O'Connor, former Supreme Court Justice, her husband had Alzheimer's. I believe it was Alzheimer's. And she checked him into a home and she used to go visit him. And slowly but surely over the years, he forgot who she was. And then, to make matters even more difficult, he fell in love with a woman at the nursing home. because he didn't remember that he was married, that he had a wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sandra Day O'Connor would show up at the nursing home and her husband would excitedly tell her about how he went on a date with whatever the woman's name was, Gloria. They went on a date and they had lunch in the garden. And Sandra Day O'Connor was asked, how in the world are you coping with this? And her answer was very beautiful. And I'm paraphrasing all of this, by the way, and sure. I'm sure I'm getting details wrong and I apologize. But the paraphrased answer was that she loved him and he was happy. And at some level, that's what mattered to her, is that her husband of however 50 years or whatever, she was watching him. He was much happier now. He had like this thing in his life that was making him happy. And she put her personal self-interest aside in the name of seeing a person that she loved be happy. And that I like the idea of that is mind-blowing to me. That is a truly, like, your life partner doesn't recognize you is bad enough. And then that life partner moves into a different world of love is shocking and insane. And I read that, I think it was in the New Yorker years ago. And I've always thought, like, that is a model for how to live a selfless life, right?
That's
there.
Sacrifice.
Like,
That's
it's the ultimate sacrifice. It's that she loves this man. Circumstances beyond either their control made it so that he couldn't love her back, and her interest was in his happiness and not hers.
The fact we're having this conversation right now about a television show and it's, you know, coming up fourth season makes me so grateful to be part of it. Uh-huh. Mike, thank you so much. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And I will make it even worse to ask if the poem Parting by Emily Dickinson was at all a reference for this.
It was not really a reference, but it has been raised to me a couple times since the episode was executed by a couple different people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful poem and also deeply sad. When we committed to this very sad sort of downbeat ending to the season, the idea here is to resonate, I think. If this can resonate with people in whatever way that means, if people can find connection to it in their personal lives, their own lives, their family's lives, whatever, that will mean that we have done a good job. And I think that so far, according to the people who have seen it, that I've shown it to, that seems to be the case.
Wow.
I think it's important that if this is somebody's first exposure to The Good Place, this podcast, there is a lot of 9-year-old fart humor.
Yes.
In the show. Which, very
There's
funny.
Some great dumb stuff too.
Yeah.
Mike, you framed season one as Eleanor's season. You bookended season two with Ted, framing it as Michael's season. This season, we've sort of been all over the map, but I didn't see it coming that Chidi would be the ultimate sacrificial lamb, that he would snappy, snappy, wipey, wipey, so that others may live. Like, that's surprising, and I wonder if, you know, what other heroes' journeys or sacrifices were referenced for that.
We didn't think of it as Chidi's season to begin with, but it sort of ended up becoming that.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the whole story of the year, it starts with he's the sort of linchpin, right? Eleanor goes to Australia to see him, and he's the one who has to make the decision of like, yes, I'll help you. And then over the course of the season, the next gigantic moment is when he becomes confident enough to, as Janet, says a lot of things that he feels, which is not typical for him, and then kisses Eleanor as Janet. And then after that, he's a different guy. It's more explicit. There's a longer cut that we're putting up online. And there's a couple lines from the one in the post office where he's saying, listen, you know, when she's losing her mind and is like, I hate this. This is so annoying. We're so close to heaven and we can't get out there. He says, listen, you know, I'm a world-class worrier, but here's a crazy idea. What if we don't worry about any of this? What if we just stop worrying about it and just try to enjoy ourselves and try to like be together? And that became the sort of end game for him, as we decided that once he went through that thing where he was Janet and he was in a void and the void almost blew up and everybody almost died and he just said what he felt and he kissed Eleanor, that he crossed over there. And from that point on, he's a much more confident guy. I mean, he loses his mind a little bit in the interdimensional hole of pancakes, but like, come on, who wouldn't, right? But generally speaking, he's a much more confident guy. He's much more stable. And when in the finale, when he sees Simone, he just has a look of resignation on his face. And when you go to Michael's office, he just says, yeah, this isn't going to work. You got to reboot me.
I can't do it.
Yeah, it's not going to, you got to reboot me. This is the only way. And it's not panicky. It's not hesitant. It's like, this is the answer. I'm sure this is the answer. It's going to be okay. In that scene where they watch the movie, Eleanor is kind of falling apart, and he's the one who's like, it's going
to
be okay.
That said, to see William Jackson Harper cracked voice say, I'm going to miss you so much.
I'm going to miss you so much.
Eleanor is
It's lovely, but it's also he's the one who's reassuring her because she's like, oh God. And it sort of ends up becoming sort of cheaty season at the end there.
And now a word from my totally real sponsor.
Are you looking for the highest quality education available in the state of Arizona? Then stop listening to this ad. But if you're looking for, you know, like a college that technically has classes and a football team and stuff, and you don't really care what happens to your brain once you enroll, then welcome to Arizona State University, presented by Captain Morgan's Rum. We had to sign a corporate sponsorship deal to let us keep our humanities department open, and frankly, Captain Morgan's presence on campus was already so significant, it just made sense. We offer plenty of classes that will help you in the real world, like Recreational Pharmacology 101, Nightclub Science, and Cup Stacking. That's right, there's a cup stacking class now. You get full credit for it and everything. This fall, we also welcome special guest lecturer Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who will headline the Old Sad Men Yelling About Stuff lecture series. Enroll today.
We've talked about the, you know, the glaring aspects of the show, this episode, things that we needed to. There are 1,000 things I've left out. Mike, are there things that we should know?
Here's just a couple little Easter eggs that I personally loved that people may have seen and may not have seen. In the Australia section of the season, there were a lot of dumb Australia jokes that
yes.
we've talked about, but one that perhaps was missed because it was barely visible was on the back of a magazine at one point. I don't remember which one. There would be an ad, and the ad would be like, it would look like a sort of Patek Philippe or like Rolex style ad, but
Watch.
It was for a boomerang. It was a beautiful ad. It was really beautifully made, but it was like for a boomerang called like the Q4 or whatever. And my favorite part of it was we came up with a tagline for the boomerang company that was sort of in the mold of like a, you know, like Lexus or like a high end car. Mm-hmm. And the tagline was, you know, it'll come back, but you still won't want to throw it. That was great. There's in the movie montage in this episode, at one point, William or Chidi is reading. Eleanor is teaching him about the Kardashians, and he's reading an Us Weekly.
Right.
And the little the side column boxes in the on the cover of the Us Weekly are wonderful. And there's like 3 boxes, and the top one is just a picture of a stock photo of a woman, and it says something like, "Celebrity mystery, who even is this?" and then the bottom box is another woman, sort of in silhouette, and it says, "Yet another celebrity mystery, who's this now? Is she the same woman as up there?" And it was like somehow the staff at Us Weekly had just got, there's too many celebrities. They don't even know who these people are. They're asking their readership for help. Can you help us figure out who these people are? That really delighted me. There's also a running joke in the whole series now, starring Morgan Sackett, our line producer mm-hmm. and occasional director, where we sneak photos of Morgan into the show all the time. There's one on the smart board. We're telling a story. If you go back and look very carefully, there's a story about a man named Morgan, and it's not a good story.
Is that true?
Yes.
Mike.
And, I think on the smart board, when Chidi, before Tahani comes in and announces her engagement, there's a picture of him. He's a politician. He's running for office, and he's been indicted on like 687 counts of fraud or something. Before that, on the pinup board, where when Chidi puts up the announcement saying they're running an experiment, people, if you've had a near-death experience, there's a thing up there that's like an ad for him.
Yes.
That said, with a picture of him that says like, vote Morgan Sackett for Sydney City Council or whatever. And then on the smart board, he's been indicted for fraud. And then at a later point, I won't say where you can find it yourselves. It's clear that he's on the run and the cops are looking for him. Like, we told the whole story with Morgan, with Need Nuggles, and I slipped in. And Frank Sackett, who's our post producer, who's Morgan's brother, helped us by getting photos of Morgan, and we've snuck a bunch of them into the show.
He didn't know.
No, what we would do is we would wait until the final mix, and then we would have them go like, "Oh, by the way, can you just look at Morgan? Look at this. Have you noticed this?" And he would go, "God damn it!" Wonderful. By the way, also in that smart board thing. One of this in Australia before Tahani's announcement, there's a wonderful like news, allegedly news headline, which is that there was a problem at the zoo, and there were koalas. The problem was that the koalas were climbing into the zoo cage. Like, there were too many koalas. It wasn't that they were escaping, which is usually the problem with zoos. It was that they're just extra koalas were joining the zoo, which I really like. That's about as dumb an Australia joke as
you can do. Yeah.
And then the final one, which I don't think anyone noticed, at least that I saw, that I really love, is when the monster truck in Jacksonville crushes the cab.
Yes.
Do you know what the advertisement is that's on the top and the triangle advertisement thing on the roof of the cab?
Of the truck?
The cab that gets crushed.
I feel like I do.
It's for the Mindy St. Clair Rescue Alliance.
No way.
Yes, we made an ad for the Mindy St. Clair Rescue Alliance, and then which symbolically gets crushed by a monster truck in Jacksonville, because of course that's what would happen in Jacksonville. So those are my favorite Easter eggs of the year.
That's incredible. Ted Danson, what's good?
You mean how would I define good, or what's good in my life, or just answer the question? What's good? Okay.
Yeah.
Creativity is good. Nurturing is good. Laughing is really, really good.
Mike, sure. Mm-hmm. What's good?
Okay, really quickly, because I know we're running late on time. I have five answers, I think. Six answers. Answer number one is admitting fault. I have found in my life that when I make mistakes, I have my instinct, like I think most people's instinct, is to cover your shame and embarrassment by trying to explain them or yelling at someone else or some method of just deflection. And as I've gotten older, I have gotten much better at just saying, yes, I blew it, I'm sorry. And the psychic onus that is lifted from your shoulders when you do that is so wonderful and it's such a sense of relief just say like, oh, I'm so sorry. It's one of the best things you can do. I really believe this. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that, like, when you bump into someone's car in a traffic accident, both parties often get out of the car like immediately in the quick of their skins yelling at the other person. And it always goes terribly. And when in the situations where one person gets out with his or her hands sort of raised in a mea culpa and says, I am so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, the situation is immediately diffused. And the other person usually says, it's totally okay, it's totally fine, I'm not hurt. It's like, what a relief it is to watch that version of that.
What if you lived your life that way?
Yeah, what if we all lived our lives just admitting fault? I think you can probably look at, let's say, just off the top of my head, the national political scene and find a number of cases where if certain people would just admit that they had done things wrong, the world would be moving a lot more smoothly.
Now, Agreed. The trick I've discovered is you have to be sincere.
Okay, that's one thing. Another thing that's great is in a totally different realm is the International Rescue Committee. It's a charity that I have gotten to know really well. It was founded by Albert Einstein in the 1940s as a way to help Jews get out of Eastern Europe.
Oh, right.
And it is a wonderful, gigantic international relief aid effort that just goes to, like, the most dangerous places and the most vulnerable people and tries to help them in any way they can possibly help them with food and water and shelter and safety and kindness and anything. It's rescue.org is their website. You should go look at it. And if you can throw them some money, that would be good. In another category, a completely different category, the song Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. Every time I ever hear that song, I'm just happy. It's a very sad song, and it has a sort of like slightly overblown 70s power ballad thing that's like a little embarrassing. But I have listened to it 400 million times, and I still love it exactly the same amount. And I feel like it's a rare thing that there's a movie or a song or anything that you can watch over or listen to over and over and over and over again and still love.
Yeah.
That's one of them for me. In the category of new pieces of art that I really love, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Coen Brothers' last movie that's on Netflix, it's extremely existential. It's six vignettes. It's six sort of short films strung together. I think it's six. And they're all set in the Old West. It's one of those movies where I watch it and then I've thought about it at least once a day every day since I've seen it. So I recommend that. And then the last one, in the category of like human beings, is J.J. Philbin, my wife.
Yeah.
So she's a wonderful writer and showrunner in her own right. She created the show Single Parents on ABC. And recently my daughter, it's about a group of single parents and their kids, and they're sort of like they all help each other out raising their kids. And there's a bunch of kids on the show, and recently my daughter, who is eight and likes to act, she put her on the show. And she had a great time. She's been on the show a couple times now. But it makes me so happy to think that my daughter is going to a place where her mom is the boss. Mm. That's really cool. And she's in charge. She's directing people, and people really like her, and it's a happy set. And just the idea that she's modeling for my daughter, and maybe just as importantly, and maybe more importantly, from our son, she's modeling what it's like to be a woman who has kids and a career that she loves, and she can do both, and it's totally fine, and she's the boss. And it's made me routinely over the last many, many years very happy to think that my wife is the model for our kids. And so that's what's good.
How about that for a love letter?
How about that? Ted Danson, thank you for being here and for being you.
My great joy.
In both cases.
And Mike, you, thank you for this unusual half hour of American Network Television.
It isn't an unusual half hour of American Network Television. Yes, correct.
Parting by Emily Dickinson. My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see whether immortality unveil a third event to me, so huge, so hopeless to conceive as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell. This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Thank you for listening. Podcast-wise, I'm not sure what happens next. Maybe something monthly, maybe something, maybe nothing. Either way, we'll see you next season. But don't worry, time means nothing. Until then, eat butt, you ding-dongs. Then, go do something good.
Janet, what have we learned today?
A good place was the place inside of us all along that was good.
Oh, Janet, have you been sneaking magnets again?
You've been sneaking magnets.
Oh, this podcast is available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
That was Lizzie Pace. Mm. Music composed by David Schwartz.
Edited by Trey Booty. Booty? Booty.
Oh, Janet.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.